Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Jeffrey Young, Senior Investigative Correspondent for VOA TV. Our topic on this edition of the program, the corrosive impact of corruption and how to combat it. Our guest, Stuart Gilman, corruption guru. Well, his official title is Senior Partner in the Global Integrity Group. That's an international network of high-level, experienced professionals who work with governments around the world on issues of governance and anti-corruption. He's also Senior Anti-Corruption Advisor for the United Nations Development Program, that's the UNDP, in the Arab region. With over 38 years of experience in the field, Stuart Gilman has a lot to share with us about the pervasive and corrosive effects of corruption, especially the extent to which it siphons off resources that should go toward human and economic development. Corruption is defined as dishonest or fraudulent conduct by those in power, typically involving bribery. Well, we'll talk more about corruption around the world, its insidious effects, and the different challenges it presents depending on the region, country, type of government, and culture. We'll also ask Stuart to provide us with some advice on how each and every one of you can help fight corruption in your own countries. Stuart Gilman, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Carol.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague Jeffrey from VOA TV, who is our own VOA in-house corruption expert.
Pleasure to join. Thank you.
Well, you'll be also sharing with us your insights and perspectives, Jeffrey. But first to you, Stuart. You've seen it all in all of your years. How do you define corruption? And let's make a distinction between what we call petty corruption and the bigger official or institutional type of corruption.
And I have seen it all, tragically. It is really sad because of the impact it has on countries around the world. If I were to define corruption, I would basically talk about two fundamental principles. First, you do not want public officials to use their public office for private gain. And second of all, you want public officials to show impartiality in carrying out their public duties. Each of these can morph into everything from mass corruption to petty corruption. It can morph into incompetent government. When we wind up having oftentimes crazy situations where, in effect, everybody is hired because they're a friend or a family member. And then you have governments that are dysfunctional because, in effect, the people who are in positions of power actually have no competence to carry out their authority. So it's a complex and varied theme based on those two fundamental principles.
Talk about the correlation between the type of government and corruption that you've seen. Presumably, democracies with rule of law and certain systems of accountability would have less incidence of corruption.
Well, in responding to that, let me first of all state that no country is without corruption, and we're never going to end corruption. Let's start from the base principle. The difference really relies in the effectiveness of institutions to A, prevent it, B, detect it when it occurs, and C, to prosecute or to punish effectively those people who, in effect, take advantage of their political power or their institutional power. And because of that, democracies tend to be the most effective governments around the world in tackling that particular kind of issue.
Let me turn to Jeffrey Young for a question or comment.
I think when you deal with official corruption, there's a whole package of things that need to be implemented one country after another to help ensure transparency and accountability. And I'm sure that Stuart will nod his head in agreement on every one of these. Asset declaration for public officials and for candidates. In other words, what do you own? What are your business interests? What are your stocks? What do you have in the bank? This is all important in the public marketplace. People need to know what's going on with not only public officials, but also candidates for office. Full accounting for political fundraising and for campaigns. Laws preventing the conversion of public assets to private control. We can call them Yanukovych laws. You've seen the picture of that monstrous log castle, Mizuhira, that he built.
Speaking of which, I think Stuart has some experience in Ukraine, so let's look at Ukraine as an example.
And I agree with Jeffrey on everything that he's said. I'd even go further in terms of not only having asset declarations, but institutionalizing them so you have professionals actually reviewing them. It's basically the professional analysis of that. And that's one of the tragedies of the Ukraine. In effect, they had all of these systems initially in the Orange Revolution, and then in terms of Yanukovych, it winds up disappearing. And it winds up disappearing in bizarre sorts of ways. First of all, the kind of very sophisticated banking and financial transactions that not only Yanukovych himself, but specifically his son and others in the Yanukovych regime resorted to, aided and abetted by Russian banks. I mean, one of the very interesting connections you find in Eastern Europe, especially in the former Soviet states, is that, in fact, Russian banks wind up being the source, or at least the repository, for much of this kind of corrupt activities. Bulgaria now is another prime example of this. But if you'd like, we can get back and we can deal in detail with the Ukrainian example.
Well, not so much detail, but as a way of illustrating the corrosive effects of corruption. We're talking about Yanukovych, the former president, now who's in hiding, or exile rather, in Russia. And Russia as well. You know, these kinds of countries with lack of rule of law, a way of prosecuting people in an open and transparent and accountable way.
I would agree. I think, in fact, Russia, and it's terribly ironic because the forthcoming UN Convention Against Corruption conference will be actually held in Moscow. The irony of that, given my own experience in trying to work with honest Russian parliamentarians.
Are there any?
Yes, there are.
Okay.
Please, in all seriousness,
tragedy,
in fact, of the long-term impact of Vladimir Putin on the government is to quash those kinds of voices, those kinds of activities to try and prevent corruption both within Russia, but the kind of spider web that is now crawling out of Russia and beginning to impact Belarus, Kazakhstan, and a whole host of other countries.
And you could even include Cyprus. If you look back a year ago in the spring of 2013, there was a banking crisis in Cyprus, and you should have seen the agony in Russia, in Ukraine, in Belarus. A lot of these bad actors use Cyprus as a place of convenience to hide illicit funds. And when the island went through its banking crisis, you could see these guys rolling on the floor in agony because that's the billions of dollars that they stole and they hid away. And now it's threatened. So for those of us in the transparency community, a bit of an amusement to watch this because we knew what their pain was because it was all ill-gotten gains.
And when you talk about that international transfer of illicit funds, the amazing thing is that, in fact, Western Europe, the Channel Islands, Switzerland, the United States have really clamped down big time on this. And it's like that balloon. You press down on one part, and then all of a sudden the Bahamas pops up, Dubai pops up, Singapore pops up.
BVI.
And we could go on. And what is fascinating is, in fact, there are elements now in place to begin controlling the illicit flow of these funds. And the question is whether OECD and the banking institutions under the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, have the wherewithal to, in effect, enforce those rules.
Well, Stuart, let's get back to some basics. What factors, in your view, contribute to corruption? And give us also some statistics about the impact of corruption in ordinary countries.
You can start with the gross elements. I mean, the World Bank estimated 10 years ago that corruption costs the world about $1 trillion every year. But in effect, that really underestimates significantly the impact of corruption. Everybody loves putting the numbers on it, but it doesn't count the schools that weren't built and the kids who didn't get an education. It doesn't count the bridges that weren't built and the highways that weren't built so that people couldn't get product to market to really, in effect, develop. It doesn't count a host of other things like hospitals, care facilities, all of the kinds of infrastructure that in the West we take for granted, and in many of the developing countries, they in effect don't have because of the gross impact of corruption, both at the highest levels and even at the lower levels in their own countries.
For much of 2013, I was on special assignment to the Office of the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, SIGR. Out of the more than $60 billion appropriated by Congress to reconstruct that country in the wake of the 2003 war, Out of $60 billion, $8 billion was lost through fraud, waste, theft, etc. $8 billion that didn't build hospitals and schools and other things for the people of Iraq. Exactly what you're talking about, Stuart. It cheats the future of a nation.
Jeffrey, I'm amazed because the figure is so small. I have a colleague who's worked 2 years in Afghanistan, and by and large, his conclusion is that it's a kleptocracy. The senior level officials, about 100 of them, steal 90% of the resources that are dumped in that country. And it's a tragedy because you're right. I mean, the victims are the average citizen. And in effect, they have their hands tied and they're frustrated. The origin and genesis of this are multiple fold. Some people will argue it's colonialism, but we're 50 years away from colonialism. The blame has to stop. And at some point, you need to really look at the officials that are elected, the inability of elections to be fair and free so that people can, in effect, challenge people, the inability of governments to really clamp down because there's so many interests involved in protecting those senior people in office, and the bribery that goes on, all of the other kinds of elements that enter into it. And some of it really has to do with cultural tradition. I'll be very honest. I worked, and they're very honest about it, with colleagues in Jordan, which is really one of the major countries that are really trying to do something about corruption, but they're plagued by wasta. Wasta is connections, and they will admit the real dilemma for them is not the out-and-out bribe, but the government doesn't function very well, and in fact, businesses don't function very well in Jordan because everything is connections. You never get hired unless, in effect, you know someone or you're related to someone. And so I've been working with UNDP and the government of Jordan to begin peeling away some of those layers to see if something can actually be done about removing that kind of element within their culture from government itself.
So these people are hired independent of whether they have the qualifications.
Not only qualifications. Basically, they're hired sometimes sight unseen because they're somebody's relative, they're a cousin, and they come from my tribe. I can't not say no. And basically, this, by the way, then spills out to corruption trials. I was working in Albania, and the irony is in Albania, they've actually had to hire judges from outside because everybody's related. For a judge to get a call from his second cousin and say, "How can you convict my son? You know, you're related to him. How can you possibly put him in jail?" winds up being one of the other ironies. And I could give you a host of other examples. But there are, and I don't want to get so negative, there are really honest, decent people who are fighting to establish rule of law and really effective efforts against corruption around the world.
I would like to pursue that right after the break. First, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Stuart Gilman. He's senior partner at the Global Integrity Group and senior anti-corruption advisor for the UNDP in the Arab region. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Jeffrey Young, senior investigative correspondent for VOA TV. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. Next week, we will host Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. She will preview the U.S.-Africa Summit in early August, when many African heads of state will descend on Washington to further the U.S.-Africa relationship. If you have a question that you'd like us to pose to the Assistant Secretary, please email it to me as soon as possible at pcusa@voanews.com, and I will use your question on the show. Here's a shout-out and thank you to Mr. Monta Tanaka, a loyal listener from Japan. Well, back to you, Stuart Gilman, about corruption. And you were talking about there are honest people working hard to combat this horrible phenomenon. So I'd like you to talk about them, where they are, which countries are really making headway, in your view.
Well, I think when we talk about the heroes, and that's what basically you're talking about, people who are not only working in this, but in many cases endangering their own lives. I know, having worked as one example with Judge Roddy in Iraq, who was driven out. He is basically out of the country, had to take his family out of the country because the corruption was so massive. And he was actually doing something and training people to be very, very effective. I've seen it in Egypt. in terms of working with colleagues there, initially trying to deal with corruption in Egypt. The irony is, of course, when they discovered that Mubarak's son was the chief money launderer in Egypt, the person was not only removed, but threatened basically with losing his life. When we talk about really decent people who are trying to do an effective job, take Tunisia. Tunisia now is really on the move in terms of good governance and making sensible choices, not merely the sort of wallpaper of strategic plans, but actually implementing laws and seeing how to measure the impact of those laws on a yearly basis rather than simply saying, oh, we've got a code of conduct, oh, we have asset declarations. The question is, what impact are they having on corruption in their country? And they're taking it very seriously. Morocco, through the auspices of the king, who I think got very frightened by the Arab Spring. I hate to put it in that negative a term, but the bottom line is the new constitution does allow for great leeway. Sadly, the anti-corruption office, the ICPC, which was supposed to have its own legislation, in effect wrote legislation to make it effective, and then the prime minister's office, literally the day before submitting to parliament, submitted their own law that considerably waters down the effectiveness of that. But there are real champions within the ICPC and the Moroccan government to make changes and to drive those changes forward. A lot of people were very, very disappointed in the current Moroccan government because of that. But we're still optimistic. The voices are still there. And in fact, the discussion is still open. Lebanon, which is the Lebanese live and breathe on razor blades. They dance on them. They basically have five non-formal governments. The formal government itself actually is not bad, and they're really trying to take steps to basically deal with things like opening whistleblowing so that you can have those kinds of questions, preventing illicit enrichment, just preventing the money from getting out of the country into banks in other countries winds up being a huge task and how you go about implementing it. But they're, of course, in the terrible straits of having not only Hezbollah there, but also a variety of other militias or semi-military organizations around the country. And yet when you're in Lebanon, honestly, you feel like somehow or another you're in a resort because on the edges, all of this violence occurs. But for the vast majority of people, it's just everyday common enjoying life being very positive. In Thailand, they made a really great effort. Obviously, under the military now, it's under question, but they really made a great effort with their anti-corruption commission and were very, very effective. Slovenia, Botswana, both have excellent anti-corruption efforts in terms of working effectively, and not merely on paper, but really beginning to see that impact.
What about India? There was this big anti-corruption campaign. What kind of results do we see there?
I think it's very difficult because India is such a large country, and it is, like the United States, a decentralized country. The states have immense amount of power. I'm very optimistic about the new government. I'm hopeful that they will begin imposing on the state governments the kind of laws and rules that they're trying to have at the federal level. The problem is when you get to Uttar Pradesh, when you get to Kerala, when you get to other sections within India, the corruption still is rampant. And if they got it under control, the sadness for me is think of the amount of resources they could put to increasing the life expectancy, the quality of life for the average Indian, that it simply in effect is sand that drains through the hands in the form of corruption.
How about a question from Jeffrey?
I think, Stuart, you would probably agree with the report that recently came out from Sarah Chase over at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace on something that the transparency community has known for years, and that is corruption fuels insurgencies. When you have grand corruption, when you have whole groups of people within a country that are denied economic opportunity, a place at the table with a plate of food, if those people are not only economically marginalized, but also politically marginalized, and we see that in Syria, we see that in Iraq, this fuels insurgencies. This is a major report. It's under Carnegie, and people can look for it there. But it connects the dots. When you have deprived people, they turn to the gun because they have no other way to politically and economically express themselves.
I would agree, but I guess when you're talking about people who turn to the gun, the vast majority of people don't turn to the gun.
True.
It only takes a small group to energize these populations and who will support the people with the gun simply because they offer something different.
True.
And look at Nigeria. I mean, Nigeria is a mess. by and large, Nigeria, if not the wealthiest country in Africa, might actually be one of the wealthiest countries in the world. It is absurd. And I'm sorry, Good Luck Jonathan should be ashamed of himself in terms of what he has not done in terms of capturing and dealing with the kind of economic poverty created by corruption. And the governors of the states in those oil fields are criminals, by and large. They're kleptocrats, and they're kept in office simply because of the amount of money they can steal and then buy elections.
Well, Stuart, we have an enormous audience in Nigeria. What message do you have for our listeners who probably agree with you? Is there anything the individual can do to help combat and turn the tide of this terrible trend, but at the same time not hurt themselves? Because, of course, there's retribution. People may be worried about their own safety.
Social pressure is critically important, especially in countries like Nigeria. Nigeria has a relatively free democratic process at the national level. And I think accepting leaders who are not going to focus on anti-corruption efforts as their job number one is simply unacceptable in this day and age. When you look at the amount of liquidity, that's almost a pun because of the oil revenues, but exactly. If you look at the amount of liquidity in the Nigerian government and how poor off the average citizen is, the tragedy is when you look at Lagos or you look at Abuja, and if you look at the kind of fomenting of revolution in the more Muslim states in the Northeast and Boko Haram and all of the other kinds of issues that are ongoing, it is ludicrous that the Nigerians don't have one of the strongest armies in the world to defend themselves from it. And nobody is asking that question. And I think the average Nigerian needs to sit back and say, enough. Enough. We need to stop this. Nobody is benefiting from it under the very top level of the bureaucracy. You got rid of Abache. The bottom line is the Nigerian people deserve better. And Good Luck Jonathan, who I was very optimistic about initially, has, I think, failed them miserably.
I think another thing that is important in trying to put a handle on corruption and gaining control on it is what are called beneficial owner laws. Okay, now we're getting back into the financial thing. We get back into BVI, the British Virgin Islands, and the United States state of Delaware, which makes all of its money in corporations. Delaware doesn't have a sales tax. Delaware doesn't have a lot of taxes. But corporations file to become a corporation in Delaware.
Because 90% of U.S. National companies file in Delaware.
And they create anonymous corporations that we need what are called beneficial owner laws that specify you must say who owns this corporation, who controls this corporation, so we have accountability.
So, Jeffrey, bringing up now the issue of the United States, certainly the United States is not a paragon of virtue. The economy is very big. A lot of corruption can be hidden and nobody would know the difference. We do, though, have a lot of accountability. We have mechanisms, Stuart. Our IRS is formidable. If somebody doesn't file their taxes properly, they know that they will be punished. So give us a sense of the United States. Where do we rank globally on this corruption index? And what are both the positives and negatives?
Well, this sort of contradicts the loudest political voices in the United States. But the irony is corruption at the federal level is in fact relatively minimal because of the incredible oversight. You have inspector generals in over 70 departments. You have an Office of Government Ethics. You have not only whistleblower protection, you have the Office of Special Counsel designed to protect whistleblowers who have had actions taken against them. You have a Federal Election Commission. A lot has been done to weaken these, and I really want to emphasize that. But by and large, they're very strong. But underneath the iceberg, you have the state and local levels. And let me give you my own state of Virginia. The state legislature has become a cesspool of conflict of interest. It is an embarrassment. The old days, as they said, there was no need for laws because gentlemen were in government, which was not true then, but now it's just embarrassing. There are 11 legislators for the state of Virginia under investigation by the federal government right
Johnny
now.
Johnny Williams.
And, yeah, I mean, you have the governor, the former governor. And where the governor is right, by the way, is he didn't break any state laws because there are no state laws.
It's that loose.
And it's not only here. It's Texas. It's Wisconsin, California,
New Jersey.
The Council of Government Ethics Laws used to accumulate news articles every month on corruption from all of the state levels. They would run 200 to 300 articles a month on state and local level corruption. And that's one of the places that the United States is most vulnerable. And because, I'm sorry, Carol, you live here, you're not terribly interested in corruption in Iowa, although it's a major corruption case the federal officials have mounted. And the tragedy is, it always is the federal government that winds up doing the indictments and doing the investigation. State level, they're almost irresponsible in the United States, and it's embarrassing. People tell me, well, what system would you recommend? I say, well, not the United States. Maybe Canada, Slovenia, maybe Botswana, but I sure as heck wouldn't recommend the United States as a model.
Well, for final words, Stuart Gilman, with all your cumulative experience around the world, how do you see the trend toward fighting corruption? Are you optimistic, pessimistic? How do you see it?
I'm optimistic. There are many fine organizations such as Transparency International, Global Integrity, which, by the way, has nothing to do with my organization, that in effect are really making corruption not only a theme, but they're keeping the pressure on countries around the world to pay attention to this. And I'm actually optimistic. With all that I've said, I'm really optimistic because at the end of the day, we've sort of unloosed this anti-corruption effort. And there's a great quote that I love to use from Victor Hugo, that greater than the march of a vast army is an idea whose time has come. And the anti-corruption effort is an idea whose time has come. It will continue to have an impact, and I hope will have an impact on the average citizen in countries around the world, making their lives a little bit easier, making their prospects better, and making their futures brighter.
Stuart Gilman is a senior partner at the Global Integrity Group and senior anti-corruption advisor for the UN Development Program in the Arab region. Stuart, thanks so much for your time. Terrific insights.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Nick Ivanov. And joining me on the program was Jeffrey Young, a senior investigative correspondent with VOA TV. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.